I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For former members of the armed services, reintegrating into civilian life can sometimes be quite a battle. Today, how entrepreneurship gives some veterans a chance to use their leadership and resilience training to start businesses. Then we'll check in on what's the holdup on bike lanes in Kansas City. After a series of bids and readjustments, is there still a chance for federal dollars on the horizon? Find out more about the city's latest proposal that hopes to bring in funding and help cyclists along the downtown loop. After that, we wrap up with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. From homelessness to suicide, we hear all the time about difficult issues that the veteran community deals with every day. But with more than 3 million businesses in this country owned by former members of the armed forces, could entrepreneurship be one way for some veterans to reintegrate to happy, healthy civilian life? Owning a business is not a cure-all, to be sure, but my guests today think it's a piece of the puzzle. Joining me today are Herb C. He's a co-founder and managing partner of Think Big Partners, a company here in Kansas City that's devoted to incubating entrepreneurship. Herb was a pilot in the U.S. Army. Herb, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks.
Mike Nixon is also here. He's Senior Vice President of Armed Forces Insurance up in Leavenworth, which helps connect veteran-owned businesses in all 50 states with affordable insurance providers. Mike, nice to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Darcella Craven is joining us from her office in St. Louis. She's president and chief fear conqueror of the Veterans Business Resource Center, which serves Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, and Southern Illinois. Darcella works in combat communications for the U.S. Army. And Darcella, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Darcella, right off the bat, I've got to ask you about that job title, chief fear conqueror. Is that on your business card? And what's the story behind the title?
It is on my business card, and it is on our website. The story behind it is I've been doing this type of entrepreneurship space for a very long time, and one of the biggest issues that I see with entrepreneurs in general is the fear factor. Many times they don't move because they're just afraid to, or they don't get off the entrepreneurship train because they're afraid to. I just decided that, well, one, since I run a company, you can change and make your title anything you want. That's one of the perks of being in charge, right?
Yes.
Then the other thing is really just want to make sure people know that fear is a big factor in this whole process. So.
This is amazing to me because we're talking about guys and gals who have been trained to fire weapons and drive tanks and fly helicopters. They really do a lot of tough stuff. So what's to be scared of after all of that?
Oh, goodness. Losing everything you own, facing your family as you walk in the door and say, hey, honey, guess what? I just lost $80,000 in a bad deal. Or oh, my gosh, actually having clients and customers walk in the door and ask you to do the thing that you just advertised you could do. All of those things can really stop a person from making a move. Part of what we do in the entrepreneurship space outside of all of the other technical stuff and accounting stuff, et cetera, is really help them mentally prepare for the next step. It is really no different than any other combat situation or deployment in the military. You've got to prepare for what you may or may not have to do.
Herb, I was going to say, are there skills that recruits are taught in the armed forces that somehow easily translate when it comes to starting a business?
Well, being an entrepreneur, you certainly find yourself in harm's way very often. Maybe after getting yelled at, you are desensitized into submission. But I think the mindset of taking a problem, breaking it down, and finding a way to be successful, being very mission and goal-oriented. You know, entrepreneurship is a series of goals. It's a ability to, you know, come up with an idea, find a way to bring it to market, find a customer, you know, solve that customer's needs, and then keep that customer. I think those are a series of goals and challenges, and I think they teach a lot of those problem-solving skills and adaptability and improvisation in the military.
So the answer is yes, it sounds like.
I think so.
Now, we want to hear from listeners, too. If you're a veteran who has started a business or you know someone who is, call us and share your story. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Does the Department of Defense, Mike, offer service members resources for starting their own businesses?
I don't know, to be honest.
Darcella, what weigh in there?
So absolutely. Right as people are transitioning now, when they're going through their transition assistance program, there's a program called the Boots to Business class that is usually on every military post, and they can attend it. It's a two-day entrepreneurship class, 10,000-foot view. We bring in people from the surrounding community, experts, lawyers, people who such as Herb, who do things like help people start businesses and have them tell them what it means to start a business from, again, that 10,000-foot level. And then off post, for those men and women who maybe can't get back on the military post, we do what we call a reboot class. And that is all funded through the Small Business Administration and work in partnership with the DOD.
Herb, what was it like for you when you left the service? I mean, did you have a plan in your hip pocket?
You know, I had a plan, and, you know, as a helicopter pilot, you take off expecting to crash, so you always have a plan B, C, and D. But my, you know, my plan started out in the finance space. I worked in the investment industry for a Wall Street firm. But really, you know, the plan changed quickly because you realize that even though it was, you know, I was a financial consultant for Merrill Lynch, which is a great firm, there's a lot that goes into being in that business. It's not just about understanding, you know, the core of the domain expertise of stocks and bonds. It's understanding how to actually conduct that business.
So how scared were you when you left the service? I mean, were you worried about reintegrating into civilian life and all of that?
You know, candidly, Steve, I think there was a level of fear. Of course there was. But I think, you know, the gift of youth is that you don't always know what you should be afraid of.
Yeah.
And I was 28 when I got out of the military. I'd been in for 11 years. And you know, you learn as you go, and it's a series of learning experiments and really the opportunity to be able to learn in an environment and figure things out. There's no better way than to get your hands dirty and figure things out. And, you know, it's just like putting up a tent in the desert. You know, you can read the manual, but until you do it, you don't really know what's involved. You better just start.
That's interesting. Darcella, starting a business can be complicated, of course. There's more to becoming a mechanic, for instance, than just having a garage and some tools and a know-how to fix cars. Are the challenges a veteran entrepreneur faces any different than what a civilian is going to come up against?
As a whole, no. I mean, everyone is going to come up with, have the same challenges. You don't have enough resources. You never have enough time. You never have enough, et cetera. However, we do find over the last 13 years that some of the challenges that veteran entrepreneurs may have is not understanding the network in which they're going into. Remember, when you're in the military and you jump from one duty station to another, there's a sergeant or an officer that is assigned to you to take you to the PX, take you to the finance place, et cetera. When you get out of the military, there really isn't someone who meets you at the front gate and says, okay, well, let me show you how to get to this and that.
Right. So how do you help?
That's one of the biggest challenges.
How do you help a veteran overcome that?
They can attend many different programs. One, the Boots to Business. There are veterans business outreach centers across the country that are designed to help be that person that takes them to, for example, that takes them to the local SCORE chapter or that takes them to the local small business development center that is helping out. So that's one way that we do that. We also offer classes as well in conjunction with those other resource partners. And perhaps you might not have a resource partner in the area. The Veterans Business Outreach Center knows who the people are in the community who are making a difference, like maybe Think Big or one of the other programs that are around that people might not know about.
Mike Nixon with Armed Forces Insurance. I'm guessing that insurance might be one of those easily overlooked steps to becoming a business owner, especially in such a litigious world that we live in right now. Am I seeing that right?
It oftentimes is. And that's where we try to help to explain to a veteran that's starting their own business what they might need to get to protect that business and to protect their assets.
Do you find that most veterans, are they ready to go, Mike, or is there a certain naivete that you're having to battle as you talk to these guys?
There's all levels, just like in regular business. There's people that are, you know, we deal with people that have already established and they've been ongoing businesses, and then we deal with people just starting out. Maybe they recently got out of the military and they're going back to work as a consultant. and there's liability coverages they might need.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888 as we talk about veterans entering the business world after their time in the service. Cynthia from Overland Park, you're on UpToDate, Cynthia.
Good morning. Listen, I hope you guys are aware of the fact that the city of Kansas City, Missouri, has a special certification process for minority women-owned companies. There's also a category for veteran-owned companies. And this certification process allows veterans to compete for the city's, get ready for this, over $1 billion worth of business of contracts offered by the city, ranging from construction, subcontracting to procurement. And it's headed up by Philip Yelder. He's the director for the Human Relations Department. And that is a whole set of rules and structure available for people to, number one, of course, get your company started, but also being able to access city contracts. And then there's a whole slew of various organizations who support the development of contractors and their companies. So it's a big area. I mean, especially for veterans.
How does a veteran connect with that organization, Cynthia?
Well, it's a city department. It's part of Kansas City, Missouri's department. It's Philip Yelder in charge of the Human Relations Department. And his the website is www.kcmo.org. Then you type in Human Relations Department or Philip Yelder, and you go to a site that shows you all the rules for getting yourself certified, and also their support programs. One of them that I help manage help you to become viable to actually compete for some of the business. We're talking from construction down to selling paper clips, but there's a ton of business available for someone who's a veteran certified company.
Cynthia, hang on a second. Herb, are you familiar with this?
You know what? I'm not. And it's great to know that I'm not surprised the city of Kansas City, Missouri has done a lot of really progressive things.
Right.
To be able to support the small business community, things like BizCare, if you're not familiar with that. But that's great.
BizCare
that's great
is
information.
It's a very good group, too. But they're connected with us as well because BizCare says once you decide how you want to do it, then we'll show about licensing. But first of all, get yourself certified, which means you're in the golden seat to have access to these contracts.
Darcella, you're over in St. Louis, and I'm wondering how common is it that cities like Kansas City offer the kinds of programs that Cynthia is describing to us here?
Oh, absolutely, and I think I couldn't have set that up better. I don't even know Cynthia, but I think I could have set that better up to say that that's exactly one of the biggest challenges, is there are so many really good, viable places for people to go, and it can be overwhelming. It can be like a huge just fire hose of information coming at you, which is why we encourage those veterans and military spouses who are interested to find someone that can help them navigate the system. But yes, Kansas City is really strong. Omaha is really strong. St. Louis is really strong. I mean, Missouri has a really, particularly Missouri, has a really strong program, and one of the challenges they're having is getting the word out to let veterans and military folks know, hey, we're here and we're here to help. And that's kind of why I'm excited about the programs like BizCare, like VBOX, like, you know, Think Big, that all these programs that can really help. And if I could just jump in real quick to say, if we could loop that conversation about insurance over and over and over again, that would be amazing, because you're absolutely right. People just do not think about the insurances they need until it's almost too late. So if we could just keep looping that over, it would be awesome.
Thank you.
Steve, do you want me to repeat the website access
please,
one more time?
Please, if you would.
It's a Kansas City, Missouri website, www.kcmo.gov, and then in the search box, type in Human Relations Department at the top of the box at the right, and then you're going to see a category that's entitled About Human Relations, and then this one website goes through all the different designations, how to apply, who to contact, a variety of ways of getting started.
Cynthia, I'm really glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You know, Mike, this notion that some veterans need help sort of navigating a complicated system, which includes insurance, how do you help people who come to you and don't know a whole lot about what they're getting into, particularly when it comes to insurance?
Well, we try to find out what their business is going to be and then what kind of insurances risk they might have, whether it's a physical risk if they have a building or product, or the liability risk if they're offering advice or selling a service.
And I imagine sometimes people see what the price tag of these things is, and that's got to make them a little nervous.
That kind of steers them towards whether they want it or not. But a lot of times you have to explain, you know, what their risk is. Like if they have nothing, I guess they have less risk. But if they have assets, they need to have enough insurance to keep people away from their assets.
Yeah. Darcella, you're a veteran. I'm wondering what it was like for you when you left the service. I mean, did you have a plan?
My plan was to get out, and I did that really well. No, I did not. I got out also a long time ago in 96 when the transition program was just kind of in its fledgling space. It is so better, much better now. There's still some kinks, but no, I had absolutely no plan except for I was going to get out and magically have a white picket fence and, you know, two cars, dog, and kids.
You're a service-disabled veteran. I'm wondering, what does that mean, and did that complicate things for you after you managed to leave the service?
It complicated only in the fact that I needed more medical assistance when I first got out. Again, remember in 95, the transition wasn't as great, so I didn't really know how to go get help for those things. Now it's wonderful I was able to get some assistance, but it did impact. I will say this, had I known that service-disabled veterans are really the only group of veterans that does have an opportunity under the Veterans Administration to get help with starting a small business, perhaps I would have started a small business earlier than I did. However, we try to educate those men and women now that as they're going through the transition program and they may be considered service disabled, and sometimes those folks are 100% where they cannot actually leave their home for one reason or another, there is a program under the VA that can help them potentially start a small micro business in their home. So that is a program that we try to educate folks on, along with the VA counselors.
Herb, I'm wondering for you, what was it like when you left the service? I mean, did you have a plan as well?
You know, I had a plan. Again, I wanted to go in the investment and finance space, but what was interesting were that there were some things that I had no idea that I was going to face.
Mm-hmm.
And
such as?
Well, you walk out, and there are a lot of unwritten rules. You know, again, to reorient it to the language of, you know, the mission. The mission is, you know, ultimately very straightforward, but there's a lot of things you've got to do that you don't understand. You know, the politics of an office, the process, the speed is very different, the vocabulary.
That's interesting.
And then, you know, reverse that, you come out with a certain set of terminology and vocabulary and mindset. And, you know, when you say some of the words that you're used to saying, people look at you like you've got two heads. But there are unwritten rules too. So, you know, the ability to decipher and have that period of time to where you're trying to pay attention and learn a whole new set of experiences and languages, you know, like Darcella said, nobody walks you around when you start out in the civilian sector. And conversely, you know, the civilian employer needs to also understand somebody's walking into a situation to where the new expectations, the new normal for that person is changing too. And there's an opportunity really to shape that person entering into the workforce or starting a company to really take advantage of that and really mold it. But it's you got to really think about that.
Veterans starting businesses is our topic. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Darcella, you've been working with the Veterans Business Resource Center since 2006, and I'm wondering, by the time they got to you, how far along are vets, you know, typically in the business planning process?
Approximately 70% of them come to us and they just have an idea. We call them our lovely pillow entrepreneurs. They fell asleep on an infomercial and they're going to wake up and they're going to be a millionaire the next day. So most of them come and they have absolutely no idea, or they've had an idea running around their head since they were kids and someone has told them that they should be an entrepreneur. Maybe they make the best cupcakes in the world and someone's convinced them that their cupcakes are better than anyone else. So most of them come to us with no business plan. We do have a couple of options to help them. Not necessarily a full-blown business plan, but there are quizzes out there. There are ways to get that idea out to make sure that it actually has legs, and it's just not a cool hobby, and that's where it should stay.
What made you want to get involved in helping veterans in a way like this?
I actually used to help women start small businesses back in 2003. I started my own small business helping nonprofits with implementing grants. And then one day an opportunity came to do the same thing for veterans, and I couldn't pass it up. It was just an opportunity for me to get back into the military space without doing PT, so I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and harass people for not joining the Army. I have no idea why you would want to go Navy, but, you know, hey.
yeah.
But no, so we get to have a lot of fun, and I get to help men and women and their families make a decision about something that's going to impact the rest of their lives, and what better life is that?
You know, Mike, you aren't a veteran, but your dad served for many years when you were growing up. I understand his penchant for entrepreneurship emerged after he retired. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, after he retired, he and my mother started a business together. They went to the antique business, and they liked the idea of being in control and having their own business and working for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and they did that for many years.
And it worked.
They were successful with it.
You know, Herb, does a veteran's length of service affect their ability to reintegrate to civilian life? Because I'm just guessing here that the longer you stay in, the harder it is to get used to being out.
You know, Steve, I think it does. I think you, again, acquire a set of skills and knowledge and experiences, and, you know, it does change the ability to quickly transition. But on the same token, you know, there's so much expertise that resides in the military. What people don't always understand that, you know, even though you have a gun, you may be somebody yeah. who's a nuclear sub-operator or a communications specialist or somebody who is working cyber warfare. And those are direct transferable skills into the civilian workforce. And if you have a long length of service and a technical expertise, it is a really valuable expertise to translate into whether it's another company or an entrepreneur opportunity. So that length of service can really work in somebody's favor if you really understand how to unlock the potential.
You know, Herb, I'm also wondering, maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but is there something therapeutic about entrepreneurship that can help ease that reintegration to civilian life?
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, when you're part of a team, and the military is one of the biggest teams in the world, but when you're able to work with other people and accomplish a mission and work as part of a team, you know, whether you're one person solopreneur or part of a large organization and growing, but really being able to serve your country and, you know, to wave the flag about economic growth and job creation and really being able to give back to the community, but giving back in the form of mentorship and advice and helping other people grow their business while they can help you too. That's one of the reasons why we sort of think big partners. But really, it is therapeutic because you're surrounding yourself with people,
yeah.
their common interests and goals. And I can't think of any other better way than to help people than to be, you know, successful as an entrepreneur.
Mike, tell us a little bit about how to find veteran-owned businesses that might help veterans begin to connect to this community.
Sure. We found a website, buyveteran.com, that you can go out to, and it'll show you veteran-owned businesses in your area. Mm-hmm. You put in your zip code. If you want to put in a certain industry, you know, like plumbing or medical
right.
or whatever, you put that in and it'll bring up veterans in that area that are doing that business.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Herb C., co-founder and managing partner of Think Big Partners here in Kansas City, Mike Nixon, a senior vice president of Armed Forces Insurance up in Leavenworth, and Arcella Craven from St. Louis. She's president and chief fear conqueror of the Veterans Business Resources Center. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back here, we'll talk about the struggles that bikers are facing in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we got recommendations on 100 things to do in America before kicking the bucket and learned the possible effects of Missouri's new photo ID law at the polls. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. On tomorrow's show, find out what a history vending machine is and why you'll see some in the River Market. Also, are we remembering Amelia Earhart for the right reasons? We can learn more about the famed Kansas pilot. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, right before Christmas, a city audit found that Kansas City's master bike plan was little more than lines on a map and failed to connect the city's popular destinations. What's more, the report found that many of the bike routes had not been built because of the plan's many flaws. The audit was a big setback for a biking community that had hoped that the city would achieve national recognition as a platinum-level bike-friendly community by 2020. The report made clear that platinum-level status status was highly unlikely, at least in the short term. Now, as the city tries to regroup, it's encountering some hurdles in getting federally funded bike projects on the street. We're about to find out why. With us today, Sherry McIntyre is the Director of Public Works and an Assistant City Manager. Sherry, nice to have you. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Joe Blankenship is a Project Manager for the City Planning and Development Department. Joe, welcome to you, too.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Well, let's begin with this. The bike community is pretty frustrated with the city right now that there hasn't been more progress. We spoke with Bike Walk KC's Eric Bunch last Tuesday, and he expressed some of those frustrations. Let's take a listen.
We were told back in early 2012 when we launched our bike share program at Bike Walk KC, which I think a lot of the listeners are probably familiar with, we were promised that there would be a bike lane on Grand before we launched that in July of 2012, before the All-Star game. So we actually lined up quite a few of our stations along Grand expecting a bike lane to be there. It's gotten to the point where we just don't even really know what to do anymore. I've been on KCUR a couple of times. I was on Central Standard 2 years ago, and at which point the city promised the long-delayed Grand bike lanes at that point in 2016 would be – or 2015, excuse me, would be installed that year. And then again in 2016, we had the same thing. The city keeps promising that it's going to be done in each year.
And what do they say to you? You know, Sherry, help me here. You know, promised bike lanes, they haven't materialized on Grand, bike community that doesn't know what to do. What do you have to say to Bike Walk KC's Eric Bunch here?
Well, we did bid the project, so we felt we would have it constructed in 2016. Bids were opened in June 21st of 2016. Unfortunately, the prices on those bids came in way higher than we expected, and the costs were something that was outside the reach of our current funding and budget. So we had to stop and regroup again to figure out what it was that was causing the bids to be so high and what is some of the issues. So,
and you rebid those projects, if I understand correctly.
We did. We rebid the project in late November of 2016. We repackaged them, subtracted a little bit of length, tried to talk to the contractor what it was that was causing the prices to be higher than we anticipated. And so we rebid it. Same thing happened. It came down a little bit, but it was still way beyond the budget that we had originally thought that it would cost to redo the project. And it is more than just doing Grand in this project.
You know, Eric Bunch's concern, Sherry, not to be too difficult here, date back far earlier than 2016. He's saying bike lanes that were promised even before the All-Star game back in 2012. What about that?
You know, I don't know about what all that was promised in the 2012. There was a goal. When we started, when the project was very active, there was the concept of redoing Grand. It wasn't just putting in simple bike lanes along Grand. It was what we term a road diet to occur on Grand.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Road diet is on taking the number of lanes and reducing them down, the number of through lanes. In this case, on Grand, we was looking at taking what in a lot of cases could be up to six lanes, three lanes in each direction, and reducing them down, at least removing one lane. And in some case, just having one through lane and the center left turn lane, and the remaining being for either a bus, dedicated bus lane, and then bicycle lanes. So there was a lot of different controversies and changes in concepts of what is the right level of bicycle facilities, especially along Grand. And with those higher end reuses of road dieting Grand and changing the configurations of the lanes, it became an issue of needing to work with the adjacent property owners and the users of Grand to understand that parking in some locations had to be removed. And that's not something you just randomly do, even as a city public works department. Even though we control those lanes, we don't randomly go out and make changes without communicating to the adjacent property owners and the users of the system. So we did spend at least a year or more after 2012 working towards those major changes beyond just a striped bike lane, which was somewhat envisioned originally.
So what you're saying is this process is a lot more complicated than some people might realize. Am I getting the picture here?
Yes, very much so.
You know, Joe Blankenship, again, speaking for the bike community here and listening to what they've said over the years, you know, you just get a sense that they feel that there's a lack of trust with City Hall, that faith has been broken, I guess, in some ways. What would you say to the bike community today if they were sitting here with us?
Well, I mean, I think I would say that the city echoes their frustration.
Mm-hmm. You know, we want to see progress made in the biking community, but we also have to, you know, balance those needs with other priorities in the
city. What Sherry's pointing out
here. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there's a lot of parts of our community that need new and improved roads. We have a lot of parts of our community that need enhanced sidewalks or don't have sidewalks at all that need them. So, you know, we share that frustration. I would also add that I'm a member of the biking community. I'm a full-time cyclist.
As I am.
I don't...
I'm not a full-time cyclist, yeah. But I ride to work often.
Yeah, yeah, so, you know, so when I'm riding around the city, I feel that frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm really excited about what we're doing with our new bike plan. You know, we're a few months into the process. We started the bike plan pretty soon after that audit came out. And we spent a lot of time coalescing the members of the community that could help us get to these answers. So, you know, the biking community, the business community,
right.
local residents are all on our, you know, we have a couple committees, steering committee and technical committee, that help answer these tough questions about how do we get this made.
We'll talk more about the bike plan in a moment. But again, if the biking community was here, Joe, they would say, hey, you know, other cities have navigated these challenges. They're way down the road compared to Kansas City, which remains a town, as we all know, friendly to cars, not so friendly to bicyclists. And I experience that almost daily myself. And you feel like you're taking your life in your own hands sometimes. What about that? Other cities are far ahead of us here.
Yeah, I think what that means is we have a real opportunity to learn from what other cities have done well. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to be doing throughout the remainder of this bike planning process. We have a lot of people in our community that really have a robust knowledge of types of bike facilities, how to fund them, how to build them, how to implement a plan. And we're going to pick their brains throughout this process so we can come up with something that other communities will eventually be envious of.
You know, Sherry, I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago about sort of the scope of the work involved here, because I think a lot of people, maybe myself included, when you hear the term bike lanes, I think this is pretty simple stuff. You get a bucket of white paint and you run down the street and you paint the stripes and you say bikes in one side of the stripe and cars on the other, but you're suggesting it's not that simple.
No, there's a lot of concepts that goes into making sure that it is. It isn't just stripes on the pavement. For example, the project that includes the grant, it's 12 miles of system. And so it's changing configuration. It is a lot of striping. And striping is more than just paint. It has glass beads in it to create reflectivity.
Ah.
There are the bike symbols for different methods. It isn't your standard machine that you just drive down the road. If you've ever been behind one of the striping
yes,
machines
sure.
that's driving down the roads, well, they don't do the bike symbols. That is a whole different process. It's not a machine that just instantly drives down the road.
Are there also physical, like curb-like things that get added to separate lanes sometimes and in some places around town?
Yes, we don't have as many in Kansas City area as you might see in other municipalities or other regions of the country that have different weather patterns. You know, we've tried in the, as an industry for different markers for the lanes, and we run into issues when we plow it. But even on the project we're talking about, we have traffic signs that have to be installed so we have people that, you know, understand what the biking lanes are and
right.
what their directions are. We have traffic signal adjustments because we have standards where we ideally want the signal heads that you see over the lanes or in indicating where the lanes are. So again, as we shift traffic lanes around, we adjust traffic signals. And then we also have the traffic control plans. And when you go down and you've got people in the roadway working to say stripe or put in the marker that has a little bicycle symbol in there, there's different traffic controls during construction that has to happen, and all those things are thought through by, you know, preliminary to tell the contractor what to do, and then the contractor also tells us how his means and methods are going to be. So there's more than just paint on the ground
right.
as far as activities the contractor has to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about Kansas City's new bike plan that's now being developed and what needs to happen to make this community a more bike-friendly town. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Joe Blankenship, the two projects you hear the most about that I think you're focused on most heavily right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a project along Armour Boulevard and also the Grand Boulevard project that Sherry just has been talking about. Explain what these projects are. Describe them to us.
Well, sure. I'll let Sherry kind of talk a little bit more about those details, but I think Armour and Grand are probably the most high-profile bike projects that the city would be.
Why those two streets?
They're in, you know, very high-demand biking areas. So a high-demand biking area is where people live and work, and our more established downtown urban core areas are inherently more in need of bike facilities. So mm-hmm. the project on Grand has a couple iterations. One is the idea of a buffered, painted bike lane, like Sherry was mentioning, and then the project on Armour would be what's called a parking protected bike lane, where it has that vertical barrier separating traffic from traffic from the bike movements.
Huh. And these projects would extend roughly from where to where?
Along Armour, it would be from, and correct me if I'm wrong, Sherry, but Broadway to Paseo.
Yes.
So Broadway on the west, Paseo on the east, along Armour. Okay, and Grand?
And then Grand would go from the River Market to Crown Center.
No, it goes down to 20th Street.
20th Street, right.
Okay. So roughly the path of the streetcar, only a couple streets over on Grand as opposed to Main Street here. Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. How expensive is this work, Sherry?
Well, we were estimating the work on the 12 Miles project that included Grand to be about under $600,000. The bids came in at over $900,000. Mm.
You say 12 miles. Again, I thought it was just from River Market up to 20th Street.
That's the Grand segment. The whole project that is part of, that Grand is part of, is a whole downtown loop project. That's where the 12 miles are. So we have it along Grand. Parts of it on 3rd Street got built with the streetcar, but that extends further through west on the River Market going towards Beardsley. Mm-hmm. And then it goes down Penway Parkway, along 20th Street, Southwest Boulevard.
Well, this is an entire loop, it sounds like.
It is a full loop. It was the downtown loop. It was a full loop project, so it wasn't just Grand as part of the bid project. And Armour is the limits that Joe talked about, as well as it also has activities on Benton. Mm-hmm. And that Benton segment is about 3 miles or more. I'm mm-hmm. sorry, I don't have that correct.
That's all right. But I'm wondering, too, I think if I understand correctly, that federal money is involved here. I'm wondering why. Why not save those funds for higher cost projects and use local money to deal with bike lanes, which are usually much, much cheaper to construct?
Well, when we started these projects, we were seeking federal funds just because we seek federal funds on transportation-related projects, whether it is just road, bridges, and so forth. But we have programs that are more geared towards other activities. And so to help spread our city dollars and get as much we could, we felt it was advantageous. Now, what is happening, as we found out, Grand and the Downtown Loop Project being one of the ones that were bicycle-only bidded-type projects, that federal funds requirements is also what's driving up the cost on the bids on the project. So
are you moving away from the federal involvement then?
Well, you know, we ask for federal funds, and we usually program federal funds in this region anywhere from 2 to 5 years out. And these projects were the ones where the funds were programmed out into the future, 3 to 4 years. So as this project has been delayed, we've had other funding rounds, so we were still asking for it. We are stepping back and trying to decide in the future, would we be asking for federal funds to help extend our city dollars? I mean, those programs are available.
But it complicates the whole process.
It does
though.
Complicate it. On every project we do, we put federal funds on it. There is a complication part to it, and in this case, it's become a big part of the complication.
Okay. Let me go back to Joe here and two questions, Joe. So when might bikers expect these two projects we're talking about to be completed, the Grand Boulevard and Armour Boulevard legs? What are you looking at right now?
I will defer to Sherry on that one.
All right. Sherry, you're on.
Well, at this point in time, because there is a lot of activities that are paint and striping as part of the project, we know that as we head into late fall and through winter months, that it is not ideal time to put down paint and the other higher end material for striping that we use, because a project is not all just paint. We higher end material lasts longer, so it's mm-hmm. better value. So given our bidding process with the city and the time it would take, we would be potentially looking into winter before construction to start. So realistically, I'm going to say it's sometime next year if we're successful in bidding it. We are working on combinations of, again, repackaging the project and seeing right. what we can do. We've asked for some differences in amendments in our federally funded requirements to help see if that will help attract a better competitive bid process. Mm-hmm. And we are looking to combine the downtown loop project with the Armour-Benton project. So then again, it's bigger. So maybe as a bigger project, we can get a better value per scale to bid the projects. And so as soon as we get approval from the federal agencies to allow us to change some of our bidding requirements that they have upon us, then we would be putting it out to bid probably this fall.
This sounds really complicated.
It is very complicated as far as the different rules associated with.
And we're just talking about bike lanes here, and it sounds like this thing is a mountain to climb. You know, I'm wondering, Joe, maybe you can talk about where we are with the new bike plan that's being redone in the wake of the last bike master plan, which the city had criticized so heavily. Where's that process right now?
Yeah, I think we are in a good place in terms of where we're at in the process. We began public outreach this spring. We had a series of meetings throughout the city. We had really good online and in-person participation. Right now, we're working with Public Works and our Parks Department and some other members of our technical committee to reevaluate the network and make sure that the network is going where it needs to go. In the fall, we're going to be moving into a really robust conversation about implementing this plan, mm-hmm. funding strategies that this plan needs to have in it, and then begin the adoption process.
But there's no question the city is far behind where it wants to be. Do I have that right?
You're right.
You know, the master plan that was on the table here that the auditor criticized as little more than lines on a map. You know, the auditor's report also said the 14-year-old Bike KC plan and its implementation lacked most of the recommended elements of a bicycle master plan. That's not all. The audit also said the city's bike plan did little when it came to identifying the projects, policies, and programs needed to fully integrate bicycling as a viable mode of transportation inside this community. This is pretty painful to listen to here. Joe, how did this happen?
I think since the early 2000s when BikeKC, which is the plan's name originally, was adopted, just nationally, locally, there's been a lot of strides made to really know how to make your community a better one for biking. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is we have a clear vision and goals that we're strategizing about. We have an implementation strategy conversation that we're going to be having. And we're going to address every point in the auditor's report because they really gave us a foundation on how to build a great bike plan for this city.
How far did this setback, how far did it push the city back when it comes to integrating bikes into our transportation network here?
I don't think it set it back at all. I think it's moved the conversation forward in a more rapid manner.
But bikers would disagree. They say we should be far further along, as you said, than we are right now.
Yeah, I think in terms of actual infrastructure on the ground, I think a lot of us would agree that we wish there was more infrastructure on the ground than we have. But doing this plan the right way right now is going to help our Public Works Department, help our Parks Department, help our city leaders say, you know what, if we want biking to be a priority in the city, our city leaders, meaning, you know, those inside City Hall, our elected officials, need to dedicate funds for it. And we need to implement this plan that the community is going to be spending 15 months working
yeah.
on.
Now, we talked with Eric Bunch at Bike Walk KC last Tuesday, and he's worried about the long-term effects these repeated delays will have on people's confidence in City Hall's ability to execute all this. Let's listen to what he had to say.
I think a lot of people are feeling a little down and out about the city's promises, and I think that the trust has been at an all-time high citywide, and that's reflected in the GO bond vote, which overwhelmingly passed. But I think that the people who are living in the urban core who really, really want these bike lanes built are really, really losing hope. And I don't think it's the city itself. I think everyone has high hopes hopes for the city and seeing it progressing in really great ways, but I think it's just the implementation is just not there.
Joe, give me a quick response to that, if you would. I got to move on to a different segment.
I think I agree. We need to make sure that we're talking about implementation and funding in this plan. If you care about biking in the city, make sure your elected officials know about it. We have to have them help us execute it.
Joe Blankenship, Sherry McIntyre, both with the City of Kansas City. Thank you both for the good update on bikes. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up, Bill Brownlee and this week's Local Listen. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I'm well, Steve.
You want to talk about a local guy, Mac Lethal.
Yes, Mac Lethal is a hyper-intelligent and painfully self-aware rapper who's been one of Kansas City's most compelling entertainers for 15 years.
I was going to say enduring as well, right?
Yeah, he's now in his late 30s, and he's made adjustments accordingly.
Let's listen to Mac Lethal, this track, Sunstorm, from his 2007 album, 1111.
Conflict resolution. That's damn sure not a specialty. I want to thank everyone for listening to the album that they just listened to. Please don't take out your lighters, though. It's kind of sad. I'm from the meth lab city of broken dreams and cracked out dopamines, where everybody's looking for an ocean scene, where Pac and Biggie are passe, cause back home we speak in terms of Mac Dre, Fat Tone. I'm from a city where there's actually people that are bothered by the thought of homosexual marriage, the Bible Belt, friendly smiles and Christian steeples, and names like Bobby Sue Jenkins and Belinda Peoples. This town is so eerie when it snows, all the trees look like ghosts appearing from the road. The crows flew south to heaven and found the elixir. The echo of silence whispers from the mouth of the river to say, yeah, the city could be great one day, but the first step is getting out of our own way. I've been to bigger cities.
That's Mac Lethal, Sunstorm, from his 2007 album 1111. And you know, he's a rapper born and raised in Kansas City. Bill, what sold you on him? And I'm just struck by the use of the acoustic guitar for a rapper in that last track.
Yeah, this is in many respects an atypical song. This is from, as you said, 1111, an album that came out 10 years ago. This is the song that closes the album. You know, the album's filled with bangers that are meant to inspire, you know, drinking and drugging. But on this last track, he, you know, takes it back and says, I'm from Kansas City, and I'm here to stay, and this is my life, and I'm not the smart aleck you think I am.
What sold you on him?
He obscures the fact that he's an incredibly wonderful technical rapper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in his more recent career, he's kind of had two careers. One as a straight rapper, you know, that we're hearing here in some to some
right.
extent, and then in more recent years, he's become a internet sensation. Just last week, he put out a new YouTube video titled The History of America, told in 27 rap styles. It has a third of a million views already.
Wow.
And it showcases his understanding of hip-hop and rap and of non-hip-hop and rap subjects like American history.
He's something of a TV personality, too, isn't he?
Yeah, he hosts a show, kind of a street-oriented quiz show on MTV called Binge Thinking, and that suits him. I've always thought that he'll end up as maybe a morning radio shock jock type person, and he's headed in that direction.
He's also had a few novelty songs that went viral as well.
Right. In addition to the piece I just mentioned, he has a thing up on YouTube called White Kid Raps Fast, and it just blew people's minds how this Kansas City guy is able to, you know, rap at phenomenal speeds. I think he, in terms of speed, he may be able to go faster than Tech N9ne.
No kidding. That's Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. I should point out that Mac Lethal performs at the Riot Room on Friday, right?
That is correct. It's one of his big annual shows.
Okay. Bill, always good to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, learn why a local photographer is vending history of the River Market area, and we remember famed pilot Amelia Earhart. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.